This is BBC Radio 4. Now time for Archive on 4, and this week the comedian Robin Ince looks back at the life and archive of one of his great heroes, the scientist and philosopher Bertrand Russell, and his role as one of the first great popularisers of intellectual thought. In Bertrand Russell, the first media academic.
It has been common among philosophers to begin with how we know and proceed afterwards to what we know. How we know is one small department of knowing what we know.
He wasn't even born when radio was invented, so he adapted himself to the new media with very conscious determination.
He wasn't just famous for appearing to be an intellectual, he actually was a genuine intellectual.
He's the great example of somebody who can be both, and I think he still commands a lot of respect.
He knew that it was the way to get his ideas across to a much broader public than would otherwise be possible.
Bertrand Russell was a mathematician and philosopher, an earl and an atheist, a peace campaigner and moral reformer. He was also, I think, the first intellectual star of the modern media age. Before Jacob Bronowski explained the ascent of man, before Kenneth Clark showed us civilization, before some physicist called Brian Cox used jazz hands to explain that entropy would be the end of it all, Bertrand Russell was bringing often radical thought to large radio and television audiences. Already 50 years old when the BBC began in 1922, Russell was a radio and TV presence, educating, questioning, and often riling the public until his death in 1970. I was born in a village once owned by the Russell family. Next to the village church is the Bedford Chapel, resting place of notable members of the Russell family, including Bertrand's grandfather. I may have become aware of the Russell family via the church, but it was their most famous atheist progeny who captured my imagination. Though 30 years on, I'm still some way from finishing all of the 71 books he published. And according to Nicholas Griffin, director of the Bertrand Russell Archive at the McMaster University in Canada, his earliest written works hardly hinted at the popular fame that was to come.
He wrote a popular book on philosophy, which sold quite well. It's still in print. It's still the way a lot of people read their first philosophy and get interested in the subject for the first time. But apart from that, he was sort of regarded as the most forbidding and obscure and abstract of all the philosophers currently working. So he had a very sort of non-popular reputation at the time he started.
I doubt any mathematician has read that book. It will be in every mathematics library, but, you know, I defy you to find a I certainly haven't read it.
Marcus de Sotoy, discussing Principia Mathematica, one of Russell's most important academic works, and tackling his first great obsessions, logic and mathematics. Co-written with A.N. Whitehead, they set out to prove some of the basic truths held in maths. How do we know that 1 plus 1 equals 2, for example? Hugely important in the field of mathematical philosophy, it remains one of the great unread works of history. Russell himself estimated he'd only met 6 people who'd actually read it, and it turns out Marcus isn't one of them.
I know about it, and of course everyone jokes, my God, it took, you know, whatever, 300 and odd pages to prove that 1 plus 1 equals 2. But I think that the actual idea of the project was incredibly important, and therefore it was important to write it.
Not only was Principia not a bestseller, publishers Cambridge University Press estimated the cost of printing it would be so much that the two authors had to contribute £50 each to ensure it made it out of the printing press. In one of his most famous television interviews in 1959, interviewer John Freeman spoke to Russell about how he first fell in love with the subject of mathematics.
My first lesson in mathematics I had from my brother, who started me on Euclid. And I thought it was lovely stuff I'd ever seen in my life. I didn't know there was anything so nice in the world.
Can you remember and tell us about that first lesson?
Oh, yes, I remember it very well. But I remember that it was a disappointment because he said, now we start with axioms. And I said, what are they? And he said, oh, they're things you've got to admit, although we can't prove them. So I said, why should I admit them if you can't prove them? And he said, well, if you won't, we can't go on. And I wanted to see how it went on, so I admitted them pro tem.
Russell's early mathematical and philosophical work dealt with the search for certainty. He wanted to find something he could be sure of, and the intellectual effort almost destroyed him. Marcus de Soto again.
He had this view that all the truths of mathematics should be provable. And I think this was his goal, in a way, to show that all the things that the new theorems that had come on the scene at the end of the 19th century ultimately could be reduced to pure logic. And ultimately, he did fail in that task, because Gödel, a few decades later, proved that there are truths of mathematics, true things about numbers that we will never be able to prove or disprove. So in some sense, what Russell was trying to do with that project did fail. And I think that is really perhaps why he sort of left mathematics in some way, because his first love of mathematics, he's kind of left that behind and went more to sort of other ideas of philosophy. I mean, you don't really see Russell doing any real mathematics sort of post-Principia. I think it really burnt him out.
Such reflections have led me to think of mathematical exactness as a human dream and not as an attribute of an approximately knowable reality. To my mathematical soul, which is attuned by nature to the visions of Pythagoras and Plato, this is a sorrow. The world of mathematics and logic remains, in its own domain, delightful, but it is the domain of imagination. Mathematics must live with music and poetry in the region of man-made beauty, not amid the dust and grime of the world.
Principia Mathematica, is what kind of person could approach it and get even within 50 pages? I mean, if I put it as a non-mathematician, as a non-scientist, how technical is it as a work?
It's a highly technical work. But on the other hand, I think there are parts of the whole project which have gone into the popular imagination. What really sets Russell off on this course to try and put mathematics on firm logical foundations is that he came up with a paradox in mathematics which really unsettled everybody. And I think that that's a paradox that many people can play with and understand the sort of logical paradox which his little sort of story contains.
Known as Russell's paradox, the idea that a set cannot be a member of itself became one of the great logical conundrums of the early 20th century.
One of my favourite books is Calvino's If on a Winter's Night, a Traveller, which refers to itself in the book. So this is an example of a book which talks about itself. Other books don't do that. They assume that, you know, this is something which, you know, not talking about themselves. So you can ask, well, if you had a reference book, which two reference books, one listed all the books which refer to themselves and one which listed all the books which don't refer to themselves. It's interesting. Well, so where would the reference book which doesn't refer to itself be? Okay, so if it doesn't refer to itself, well, it should be in that reference book, and therefore, well, it is referring to itself, so it can't be there. But if it's in the other one, you also get a contradiction. So you think, okay, well, that's linguistics. Maybe linguistics has paradoxes in it. But Bertrand Russell constructed a similar sort of paradox about sets. Sets were a very important part of mathematics, sets of all the even numbers, sets of all the square numbers. So he considered, what about the set of all sets which are not members of themselves? So this is about like a little bit like the self-referential book. And suddenly here was a mathematical statement about set theory, which had a paradox in it. Because, well, which set was this in? It wasn't in itself, but if it is in itself, it should be in itself. So Russell was really worried by this. And I think that paradox is something that people sort of can understand. Is that little thing about, you know, the statement on the other side of this postcard is true. You turn it over, it says the statement on the other side of this card is false. And you get into a logical mix. And that sort of all goes back to that paradox, that logical paradox that Russell came up with, which kicked off the whole project.
There are few better signifiers of continued relevance and popularity than becoming a comic book hero 40 years after your death. In 2010, he joined the rank of that sadly rare breed of comic book hero, the super philosopher.
I was now ready to battle against my old enemy, irrationality in its highest form. To my enlightened mind, madness was a disease of weak spirits, pulling them away from the natural harmony of reason. At last, I could turn my back on my dark legacy.
Now, recently, in the last 18 months as well, Bertrand Russell is still very much his ideas alive by the fact that he's the subject of a comic book, which is Logicomics. That's right, and that's a Bertrand Russell, both a biography of him and also his journey into logic?
Yes, that's right. And the comic really uses the medium in a fun way, because you've got the author and the illustrator actually in the book as well. It's very self-referential, so sort of playing on all those games that Russell was doing in his paradoxes. So the fun thing is that it's really using the medium in actually to explore the ideas that Bertrand Russell was interested in. But I think it shows just, you know, what a great character Russell was. I mean, that, you know, he can make it into a comic book. Extraordinary.
Though his published works, including books on the philosophy of Leibniz and the foundations of geometry, meant he was respected within the intellectual community, it was the events of 1914 and his stance on the First World War that really thrust him into public prominence.
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.
I was tortured by patriotism. The successes of the Germans before the Battle of the Marne were horrible to me. I desired the defeat of Germany as ardently as any retired colonel. Love of England is very nearly the strongest emotion I possess, and in appearing to set it aside at such a moment, I was making a very difficult renunciation. Nevertheless, I never had a moment's doubt as to what I must do. I have at times been paralyzed by scepticism. At times I have been cynical, at other times indifferent. But when the war came, I felt as if I heard the voice of God. I knew that it was my business to protest, however futile a protest might be.
And protest he certainly did, and often at great personal risk. Fenner Brockway, Russell's friend and fellow anti-war activist, starts this reminiscence about one famous incident where Russell's pacifist stance resulted in him being attacked by an angry mob.
He was physically smashed up a number of times at Brotherhood Church. There's the good story which he tells there, how a woman tried to intervene against the hooligans and said to the police, won't you stop them?
The police, however, merely shrugged their shoulders. But he is an eminent philosopher, said the lady, and the police still shrugged. But he is famous all over the world as a man of learning, she continued. The police remained unmoved. But he's the brother of an earl, she finally cried. At this, the police rushed to my assistance.
In one of the many, many pithy sentences he wrote, Russell declared, "Patriotism is the willingness to kill and to be killed for trivial reasons." Russell, like G.K. Chesterton and Mark Twain, is one of the safer bets when it gets to the moment in a conversation where you need to say, I think it was, fill in blank here, who once said... My personal favourite of Russell's is The idiots are cocksure, the intelligent are full of doubt. No longer cloistered in a world of high thought and academia, Russell was by now a contentious figure, whose forthright works would lead thousands of people penning letters of both love and hate towards him. A wretched peacenik to some, and a beacon of humane and advanced thought to others. Nicholas Griffin again.
He felt from the very beginning of the war that he had to oppose it. He became one of the most prominent pacifists in Britain. He was fined, his passport was confiscated, he was put in prison, and as a result of all that, he became quite famous. He also lost his academic job at Cambridge, and although he got it back after the war, he felt he had had enough of academic philosophy and wanted to speak to a wider audience about general issues of political and social importance. And that's what he did for the rest of his life.
This is the BBC Home Service.
And it wasn't just in books and periodicals like Harper's Magazine and The New Statesman where he could publicise his views. The new world of the wireless offered further opportunities to communicate his ideas to the masses. His association with the BBC was to last more than 40 years. But according to Nicholas Griffin, Russell was far from an obvious media star.
Actually, when he was young, he was a very shy person. The very first lectures he had to give when he was 23, he said he hoped he'd break his leg before they happened, because then he could cancel them. So he was very nervous about public speaking. I think he had to learn how to address himself more simply to an audience. He did learn it very, very quickly. There's no signs of really him making false steps. And I don't know what the BBC did to prep him. I think they probably helped shape his radio persona quite a lot. But they seem to have done it very well and very effectively.
What I believe, a series of 12 talks in the form of personal affirmations by individual speakers, explaining their beliefs and conclusions on man and the universe. Here is Bertrand Russell to give the second talk in the series.
When I try to discover what are the original sources of my opinions, both practical and theoretical, I find that most of them spring ultimately from admiration for two qualities, kindly feeling and veracity.
An excerpt from one of the many lectures that he was to give on the BBC throughout the 30s, 40s and 50s, this one broadcast in 1947, on topics covering all aspects of his varied beliefs and passions, from politics to education, religion and the rewards of philosophy and, of course, mathematics. One of the programmes he became most associated with was the popular long-running series The Brains Trust, a sort of precursor to Any Questions, where intellectuals of the day would mull over such tricky conundrums as, if sleep is nature's refresher, why does the questioner wake up feeling like nothing on earth? And is it true that gods first make mad those whom they wish to destroy?
Next question comes from Mr. Smith of Canterbury. This is a very pertinent question. Could the Nazi economy have succeeded if pursued peacefully? Could the Nazi economy have succeeded if pursued peacefully? Or was the policy of aggression an admission of prospective failure? Russell?
Well, I think there are some different questions here. Could the Nazi economy have succeeded if pursued peacefully? I think it could have succeeded if it had been pursued with a measure of peacefulness, a small measure of peacefulness, just as I think Napoleon could have succeeded if he could have restrained himself a little after the Peace of Amiens. So I think if the Germans had been moderate in their war-making, they might very possibly have pulled off the whole thing that they were at, but they were too impatient.
Recorded a fortnight before VE Day in 1945, this Brains Trust does not perhaps convey the playful sense of audience inquiry that regularly peppered the series, as wryly noted by question master Donald McCulloch.
I'm afraid we're back into a rather gloomy note again. We never get any questions nowadays about flies landing on the ceiling or anything like that. Mrs. Winifred Bronson of Sidcup. Scientists and inventors devote much of their lives to reducing human employment to a minimum. That's you, Professor Heilbronn.
I don't agree that scientists and inventors do reduce human employment to a minimum. They increase human employment. You've got the enormous increase.
I think the questioner seems to me to have confused two things. What scientists and inventors do is to diminish the amount of human employment required to produce. The scientists do reduce human employment. They merely reduce the amount of work required for a given result.
Well, that's a slightly left-handed compliment, but it's very nicely put. Miss Ward?
Russell would often be the voice of human optimism on the Brains Trust, demonstrating the motivation for his thought and work, the hope of a better and safer world.
Would you agree that your enemy is not completely conquered until you've made a friend of him? Russell?
Well, I can't say I agree with that at all. I agree that there are a good many people in Germany at the present day that it is quite impossible to make friends with. People who have been debased by the regime and the situation, and who I think will just have to be put out. I don't think there's anything to be done with those people individually. But when it's a question of the German nation, I don't feel that at all. I feel that it is going to be entirely possible to wean the German nation away from the things that have compelled us to fight it, and to make a complete friend of the German nation in the course of time. It may take a considerable time, but I think it can be done. And I agree with the person who sent in the question that our enemy is not completely conquered until that can be done.
Well, we followed that, I think, as far as we can at this moment. I'm afraid that's the last question today. All the questions that we've raised will now be referred to subcommittees for final settlement. all over the world.
In 1948, Russell presented the first of what would become one of the BBC's most important contributions to the spreading of ideas, the Wreath Lectures. In years to come, they would be delivered by figures such as Robert Oppenheimer, J.K. Galbraith, and most recently by Aung San Suu Kyi. Russell chose as his subject Authority and the Individual.
We present the Wreath Lectures, an annual series of broadcasts named in honour of the BBC's first Director General and instituted by the BBC as a stimulus to thought and a contribution to knowledge. The theme of this first series of six Wreath Lectures is Authority and the Individual, and the speaker is the eminent philosopher Bertrand Russell. His opening lecture is entitled Social Cohesion and Human Nature. Here is Bertrand Russell.
The fundamental problem I propose to consider in these lectures is this. How can we combine that degree of individual initiative which is necessary for progress with the degree of social cohesion that is necessary for survival? I shall begin with the impulses in human nature that make social cooperation possible. I shall examine first the forms that these impulses took in very primitive communities, and then the adaptations that were brought about by the gradually changing social organizations of advancing civilization.
He was extremely famous by the time the Wreath Lectures were given. He had been in the United States for most of the war. He had just come back to Britain in 1944. He was very, very eminent. He was awarded the OM at around that time, I think in 1949. He got the Nobel Prize for Literature about the same time. This was the height of his public respectability. He found himself politically in tune with the immediate post-war world in a way that he hadn't been with the world before the Second World War, or that he felt later on as the Cold War developed.
I do not think that ordinary human beings can be happy without competition. For competition has been, ever since the origin of man, the spur to most serious activities. We should not therefore attempt to abolish competition, but only to see to it that it takes forms which are not too injurious. Primitive competition was a conflict as to which should murder the other man and his wife and children. Modern competition, in the shape of war, still takes this form. But in sport, in literary and artistic rivalry, and in constitutional politics, it takes forms which do very little harm and yet offer a fairly adequate outlet for our competitive instincts. What is wrong in this respect? It's not that such forms of competition are bad, but that they form too small a part of the lives of ordinary men and women.
Although at the height of his fame and popularity, Lord Wreath was not overly impressed by Russell, declaring that he had spoken far too quickly and in a bad voice. The radio critics of the day were more complimentary, even if they seemed to spend more time debating the definitions and differences of a lecture or a talk rather than what the lecture itself actually contained. But after all, for a man like Russell, who was always looking for certainty even within his definitions, perhaps you'd have enjoyed that.
We must bring to an end that discussion on Trollope. And now for radio. John Summerson.
One of the most notable broadcasts of Christmas weekend was, I think, Bertrand Russell's first Wreath Lecture on Sunday evening. The content of it was obviously of profound importance. Russell concerned himself, you probably remember, with the impulses that make for social cohesion. But I don't really want to talk about the content of the Wreath Lecture so much as its form. I wondered very much how such an experienced broadcaster as Bertrand Russell would tackle this job. Would he say to himself, this is called a lecture, but of course it's really got to be a talk? Or would he write just such a script as he would write for a formal lecture in the hall of a learned society and read it to us? Well, he took the latter course. He read us a lecture.
Perhaps there was also a reason they didn't get hung up on what Russell said. In the days before preview tapes, eminent film critic Dillis Powell had to make her excuses for missing the programme. Mind you, she imagined it was probably rather good.
In general, you would say that Russell did it right in, Summerson says, making us sit up. What do you think, Dillis Powell?
Well, unfortunately, being occupied with things perhaps not quite so high that day. I didn't listen to the broadcast. I regret it very much. But from what John Summerson has been saying, I feel sure it's my kind of talk or lecture. I'm particularly glad always to hear of a talk or lecture in which the talker or lecturer doesn't talk down or lecture down.
In 1950, having written nearly 40 books on subjects as broad as idleness, scepticism, education, Bolshevism, anarchism, meaning, truth and marriage, Russell was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature.
The concert hall in Stockholm was the setting last week for an event that happens only once a year. For here, in the city that is the home of the Nobel Foundation, were to be presented the Nobel Prizes for 1950. On this, the 50th anniversary of the foundation of these unique awards, the King and Queen of Sweden and other members of the Swedish royal family were there to attend the prize giving. The 1950 prize for literature went to a Briton, Earl Russell, Bertrand Russell as he prefers to be called. The 78-year-old writer and philosopher was cited for his versatile and important writings in which he has shown himself as an apostle of humanity.
The breadth of Russell's work means people can be drawn to him for many reasons. I started as a teenager with Wisdom of the West, a sort of juvenile's version of a history of Western philosophy, and then moved on to Why I'm Not a Christian, which still comes in handy when it comes to furious late-night debates on the internet, which I sometimes get embroiled in. Others are drawn to him by his peace campaign work or his mathematics, but all are united by the sense of passion that runs through his work.
Altogether, he was an astonishingly multifaceted intellectual and pretty much able to turn his hand to anything, writing short articles as a journalist on topics set to order and probably giving broadcasts in the same sort of way.
I began to develop a philosophy of my own during the year 1898, when, with encouragement from my friend G.E. Moore, I threw over the doctrines of Hegel. If you watch a bus approaching you during a bad London fog, you see first...
In the 21st century, it's hard to imagine a popular sketch where a contemporary philosopher is impersonated. Slavoj Žižek and Richard Rorty don't appear to be in Rory Bremner's canon. But in Beyond the Fringe, Jonathan Miller subjected Russell to the highest form of flattery.
One of the advantages of living in Great Court Trinity, I seem to recall, was the fact that one could pop across at any time of the day or night and trap the then young G.E. Moore into a logical falsehood by means of a cunning semantic subterfuge. I recall one occasion with particular vividness. I had popped across and had knocked upon his door. "Come in," he said. I decided to wait a while in order to test the validity of his proposition. "Come in," he said once again. "Very well," I replied, "if that is in fact truly what you wish." I opened the door accordingly and went in. And there was Moore, seated by the fire with a basket upon his knee. "Moore," I said, "do you have any apples in that basket?" "No," he replied, and smiled seraphically, as was his wont. I decided to try a different logical tack. "Moore," I said, "do you then have some apples in that basket?" "No," he replied, leaving me in a logical cleft stick from which I had but one way out. "Moore," I said, "do you then have apples in that basket?" "Yes," he replied, and from that day forth, we remained the very closest of friends.
Bertrand Russell is one of that rare group of 20th century philosophers, the philosopher who's respected by scientists. It's not always an easy relationship. Brian Cox, a physicist who has frequently been dismissive of modern philosophy, explains what drew him to Russell.
Yeah, I think Russell was a polymath in the truest sense of the word. He wrote one of what I think still today is the best introductions to special relativity in 1925. So it was relatively contemporary, 20 years after the special theory, 10 years after the general theory of relativity. And so I think he had a deep understanding of physics and for me, that's that marks him out as relatively unique.
Well, this is something as well about the fact that so much of his philosophical work is about how can we know what we know, and he was writing at the same time as so much was being debated over the possibilities of ideas of quantum mechanics. So in some ways, could the two things, that they were growing at about the same time, how can we know what we know, how can we have any form of certainty? And at the same time, physics was opening up a world that appeared to have uncertainty.
Yeah, if you look at the physics, our picture of the world back in the 1920s, then it was confused, to say the least. I mean, quantum theory was in its infancy. I mean, this is the time when Schrödinger and Heisenberg were writing their great papers. But neither of them, or none of the proponents of quantum theory, actually really knew what they were doing, which is perhaps a bit harsh. But they certainly didn't have a clear picture of the theory. And you know, some of the greats at the time, Einstein notably, were thought that physics was careering off in the wrong direction. So it was a time when the fundamental assumptions of the Newtonian universe, the idea that we lived in a deterministic universe and you could, in principle, perhaps calculate everything as precisely as you wanted, that idea had gone. But even the best physicists were still hanging on to it. So I think it was a real time of change in our picture of what physical theories are and what the reality is that they describe. And that's the time when Russell was writing. So it was genuinely, I think, at the cutting edge of that sort of debate.
Now, Bertrand Russell came up with an idea to illustrate concepts that we should perhaps spend time entertaining the notion of, and perhaps others where we really didn't need to get embroiled. And that involved a teapot, didn't it?
Yeah, it was actually an article titled Is There a God? And he spoke about someone who decided to claim there's a teapot in orbit somewhere between Earth and Mars. But that teapot is so small that no matter how powerful a telescope you use, you can't see it. But even so, it would be, I think the word was, intolerable presumption of the human race to argue with this statement. I believe there's a teapot there. And since it cannot be disproved, this claim that there's a minute teapot out there in orbit somewhere in space, since it cannot be disproved, then it would be an affront almost to tell me that it's wrong, tell me that it's not there. And Russell correctly points out that this person would not be taken seriously, and I think he sort of said that he might even be visited by psychiatrists and perhaps even locked up if he made this claim. But then the person might refer to an ancient book and say, here's my book, here's an ancient book, and it says in there there's a teapot, and I think it should be taught in schools, and perhaps it was, perhaps it's part of our society's mythology that there's this teapot there, and then it becomes it's a part of society, and therefore people start to believe it. And of course, he's using it as an argument against the existence of God. He's trying to contrast the absurdity of this claim of the teapot with the absurdity, as he saw it, of the claims of, for example, the Bible.
And do you think that kind of illustration is still as potent today?
Well, it is, because it challenges you to think very carefully about assertions that not only don't require proof, but are actually inherently non-provable. Because from a scientific perspective, if you make an assertion that is not provable or disprovable, then it has no information content at all, essentially. So Russell's argument challenges us to think carefully about assertions that cannot be proved by experiment.
Science is at no moment quite right, but it is seldom quite wrong, and has, as a rule, a better chance of being right than the theories of the unscientific. It is therefore rational to accept it hypothetically.
Today's media is heavy with non-believers prepared to bicker with the faithful. But Russell's atheism marked him out and created enough umbrage to cost him nearly as many academic positions as his pacifism. Speaking in 1954, in the first of a series of talks entitled Then and Now, he spoke about his struggle with religion and his desire to find, as he put it, some satisfaction with religious impulses.
At Cambridge, my interest in philosophy received a stimulus from another motive. The scepticism which had led me to doubt even mathematics had also led me to question the fundamental dogmas of religion. but I ardently desired to find a way of preserving at least something that could be called religious belief. From the age of 15 to the age of 18, I spent a great deal of time and thought on religious belief. I examined fundamental dogmas one by one, hoping with all my heart to find some reason for accepting them. I wrote my thoughts in a notebook which I still possess. They were, of course, crude and youthful, but for the moment I saw no answer to the agnosticism which they suggested.
Often asked to debate the existence of God, here is Russell in a rather stilted discussion with Father Copleston. This is a long way from the verbal fisticuffs between the faithful and the faithless that inhabit Sunday morning TV now.
As we are going to discuss the existence of God, it might perhaps be as well to come to some provisional agreement as to what we understand by the term God. I presume that we mean a supreme personal being, distinct from the world and creator of the world. Would you agree, provisionally at least, to accept this statement of the meaning of the term God?
Yes, I accept this definition.
Well, my position is the affirmative position, that such a being actually exists, and that his existence can be proved philosophically. Perhaps you would tell me if your position is that of agnosticism or of atheism. I mean, would you say that the non-existence of God can be proved?
No, I should not say that. My position is agnostic. I can illustrate what seems to me to be your fallacy. Every man who exists has a mother. And it seems to be your argument is, therefore the human race must have a mother. But obviously the human race hasn't a mother. That's a different logical sphere.
Well, I can't really see a parity. If I was saying every object has a phenomenal cause, therefore the whole series has a phenomenal cause, there would be a parity. But I'm not saying that. I'm saying every object has a phenomenal cause, if you insist on the infinity of the series, but the series of phenomenal causes is an insufficient explanation of the series. Therefore, the series has not a phenomenal cause, but a transcendent cause.
Well, that's always assuming that not only every particular thing in the world, but the world as a whole, must have a cause. For that assumption, I see no ground whatever. If you'll give me a ground, I'll listen to it. Well, I'm not contending in a dogmatic way that there is not a God. What I'm contending is that we don't know that there is. I can only take what is recorded as I should take other records. And I do find that a very great many things are reported that I am sure you would not accept. Things about demons and devils and whatnot. And they're reported in exactly the same tone of voice and with exactly the same conviction. And the mystic, if his vision is veridical, may be said to know that there are devils. But I don't know that there are.
That discussion was broadcast in 1948. But it was the events in Hiroshima in 1945 and the nuclear arms race that followed that then took centre stage in many of Russell's broadcasts and interviews over the coming decades.
Though the Atomic Energy Commission has just released these films showing the terrifying power of the bomb, further tests, such as those in Nevada, have been made since these scenes were filmed, and a bomb has been developed possessing even mightier force.
There's almost a nonchalance now when many people think of the vast weapons build-ups possessed by many countries. Yet only 70 years ago, humans did not possess the capability to destroy themselves outright, perhaps leaving an occasional mutation. With the creation of the nuclear bomb came a new and seemingly urgent cause to campaign against the build-up of weapons of mass destruction. In 1954, Russell delivered one of his most famous and influential broadcasts for the BBC.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is Bertrand Russell, OM, to talk about the implications of the new weapons and the future of the human race. Lord Russell.
I am speaking on this occasion not as a Briton, not as a European, not as a member of a Western democracy, but as a human being, a member of the species man, whose continued existence is in doubt.
The broadcast, Man's Peril from the Hydrogen Bomb, which took place in December 1954, was I think Russell's most important broadcast. It's estimated that 6 or 7 million people heard the broadcast, and both Russell and the BBC, I think, were deluged with mail afterwards. And I think it had an impact down the road on the creation of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Britain, in which Russell was also prominent.
There lies before us, if we choose, continual progress in happiness, knowledge, and wisdom. Shall we instead choose death because we cannot forget our quarrels? I appeal as a human being to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, nothing lies before you but universal death.
The fight for humanity never left Russell. When he was 89, he was arrested yet again, this time for civil disobedience at a mass sit-down in Whitehall. News footage from the protest shows he never lost his way to deliver lines that were both witty and very direct.
We think that the policy which is being pursued by the Western powers is one which is almost bound to end in the extermination of the human race. And some of us think that that might be rather a pity.
Well, Lord Russell, I believe your campaign, your new Ginger Group of 100, has said that they won't take any action unless they can get the support of 2,000 people for such a demonstration. Do you think you're going to get 2,000 for your demonstration outside the Ministry of Defence?
I think certainly. You see, the thing is, what we stand for is trying to make the population of Britain realise that it's very doubtful whether anybody in this country will be alive a few years hence. And I think there are at least 2,000 people in England who would rather be alive than dead.
Interviewed moments after handing in a protest at the Soviet embassy following the announcement that the USSR were to explode a 50-megaton bomb, here Russell's diplomacy is displayed by his compliments to the chef.
Lord Russell, what sort of reception did you have at the Russian embassy this morning?
Oh, very polite indeed, very polite reception. Sherry and tea and little round objects such as you have at a cocktail party, and very great politeness of manner, great friendliness of manner.
What did they tell you of yesterday's bomb, though?
They didn't tell me very much, and in fact they obviously didn't like the subject. They wanted to talk at large, but not about that.
Even in his 90th year, Bertrand Russell wasn't shy of standing on the global political stage. Here he is being interviewed about his response to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Lord Russell, what would you say inspired your cable to Mr. Khrushchev?
Oh, a general desire to avoid nuclear war. I also telegraphed to Kennedy at the same time. And generally speaking, I wanted, if possible, to make both sides realize that a nuclear war would be worse than the worst imaginable decision about Cuba.
His humanitarian efforts may have won him many fans, but it was his colourful personal life and his publications such as Marriage and Morals, with their brave anti-Victorian values on subjects such as birth control and sexuality, that were contentious enough to mark him out as an immoral man. With four wives and several high-profile love affairs to his name, he would certainly have been perfect tabloid fodder if he'd been around in today's celebrity-obsessed media world. In 1984, Dora, Russell's second wife, spoke to Belle Mooney as part of a series called Women of the Century. Amongst the many issues she talked about was their relationship and why his popularity and success with women was perhaps something of a surprise.
Land's End, Cornwall, the house that Dora Russell bought 60 years ago with Bertrand Russell. Dora is 89 years old. She has described her life as a quest for love and liberty. It has been a struggle for many things: birth control and equality for all women, liberal values in education, social justice, and above all, world peace. It was when Dora was 21 and still a student at Cambridge that she met the famous mathematician and philosopher Bertrand Russell. He was then 46 years old.
We did the famous walk over the downs, you know, where we were going to Shear and Gumshall and all those places. I can remember now the going up the side of the down, you know, and his curious profile. He was so like the Mad Hatter, and had his hair blowing in the wind. And I just fell in love with him then, really.
But he was much older than you, wasn't he?
Yes, well, I suppose that, you see, it was partly a father fixation that I had. Anyway, he seemed to me one of the most wonderful people I'd ever met. And, of course, he enmeshed us in witty talk and drawing us out and making us feel ridiculous. You see, we all admired him. The curious thing about Bertie was the way the women did fall in love with him. I never can quite make out why it was. Because, you see, he wasn't really the ideal lover by any manner of means.
Why not?
Because he was so intellectual.
When he made advances to you to go to Lulworth Cove, wasn't that very advanced?
Well, I said, I understand you've got a lady. I said, I don't poach. And he said, oh, that's all finished. And so I took the risk and I went down to Lulworth.
And you actually slept with him there? And
oh,
you,
yes.
You,
and oh, yes.
You
oh,
dive
yes.
naked from boats.
Oh,
and it sounds extraordinary.
I quietly crept into the room. I mean, oh, he crept into my room. I forget which way we did it. But I know he had Bob Trevelyan to live there. Bob was a little bit joking one time. He talked about strange noises in the night and so on.
Michael Foote, who described Russell as unquestionably my man of the century, discussed his life and importance with John Tusa shortly after Russell's death.
I remember at Oxford reading his book, The Conquest of Happiness, and then meeting Bertrand Russell a few weeks later, and he looked the happiest man I ever saw at that time, and indeed at almost every other time I met him. He had this beautiful smile on his face, and he seemed to live the happiest life ever. But that had been achieved against enormous odds, because anybody who reads the story of his childhood in his autobiography will see that it was an extremely unhappy childhood, bent down by a sense of sin and the wickedness of sex and the oppression that was all around him. So he had to fight through that. And therefore, I suppose that made him successful in knocking off the chains of other people, and so he developed his ideas of, which are included in his books like Marriage and Morals, which in a kind of way is the basis of the so-called permissive society, or whatever you like to call it now. Most of the things that have developed in that direction are to be found in the books that Bertrand Russell wrote, say, at the end of the 20s or the beginning of the 30s.
But, of course, he got into a lot of trouble and incurred a lot of unpopularity because of this free-thinking attitude.
Well, he was, as he said on one occasion, when I wrote to him about and asked him to review some book and hoped that he would approve it or something would be helpful, he said, I don't think it would be very helpful considering I've been judicially pronounced lascivious, obscene, and every other word, which of course was the words that were used when he was denounced in America, and when he was thrown out of America, and he was thrown out of universities in England as well. So there's both sides of the Atlantic have the distinction of having defamed the greatest philosopher of the age.
Was he, do you think, trying to do anything as shallow as just shocking people?
No, I don't think he ever did it. I think he was always out to tell the truth as he saw it, and that, of course, was one of the essentials of his wonderful style, because the simplicity of it, which was a deceptive simplicity in a sense, because the wit came out of the ideas more than any verbal trickery. The wit came out of the ideas and the simplicity of the ideas, and ideas which had never struck people before, but once they were put in Bertrand Russell's language, they were stunning in that simplicity. Stendhal said that only great men dare say things simply, and I suppose that Bertrand Russell is the finest example of that in the whole of English literature, certainly of modern English literature.
Michael Foote there. In 1972, Russell's son Conrad spoke about his father and their relationship, and it's clear from these memories why he remained such a popular public figure, always accessible and always interested in ideas and people.
One of the ways in which he was a very good father was that one never thought of it in those terms at all. And the first thing one thought of was simply that he was fun to live with and that he was amusing. And he sticks in my memory above all as an outdoor man. A man who knew his way about the Welsh mountains by heart. A man who could fascinate one with accounts and explanations of tides and caves on the beach. And a man, one of whose greatest prides was that he'd never missed a train.
But he was 70 years older than you were. Were you conscious that he was making an effort to this child, or was it a very natural relationship?
It was absolutely natural, and there was no effort involved at all. And if he was talking to anybody, whatever, he was interested in knowing what they thought. And there was no need to simulate the interest. It was absolutely, completely genuine.
But did you also gain, in the formation of your own ideas, in your own education, from living so close to such a great mind?
I'm quite sure I did, yes. And if there was anything illogical in an argument one was putting forward, it would be picked up. And if there was anything illogical in an argument of his, and one pointed it out, he would be very pleased to have it pointed out.
Did he use you, in fact, as a sounding board for any ideas, or did he pick up ideas that had come out in conversation with you and use them subsequently?
I think he probably did use me as a sounding board, and I remember him asking me about questions which I've subsequently found in his books. And I remember sitting on the beach one day, and he asked me whether one could know there were more grains of sand on the beach than were there than one could see at that particular time. And he didn't, I subsequently found, agree with the answer I gave to that question. But he certainly listened quite seriously to what I had to say about it.
But was this because his knowledge, his learning, was acquired as a sort of natural process? It was part of his living?
I think it was that it was part of his living. And except for things that really had to be done in a hurry. And most of his best work really was a form of leisured activity. And it was done because it was fun.
His near neighbour during his later years in North Wales was Clough Williams Ellis, the creator of Port Merion. He describes Russell's enduring popularity and willingness to spend time with those who were prepared to travel far and wide to visit him.
The main problem was to keep visitors at bay. He was rarely besieged by people from all over the world. Asians and Americans, especially Americans, coming over seeking to see him. He was extraordinarily liberal and kind in seeing those that he felt that deserved seeing and that he had time to see. And always, if they were dismissed or received always the utmost courtesy, old-fashioned good manners. I don't think I've ever known anybody who was so punctilious in, suavity and welcome.
Russell's popularity never waned, receiving on average 100 letters a day, most of which, with the exception of the ones which were just low abuse, he managed to reply to. To someone who sent a letter that thanked God for his autobiography, he replied, "Troubled that you thanked God for it, because that suggests he's infringed my copyright." Many letters contained myths about him, created by his enemies, which he would politely correct, and some were just invitations to tea. Like this one, from a then much younger Paul Altman.
"Dear Mr. Bertrand Russell, thank you very much for all the things you have done. I like you. If you come to Oxford, come and have tea with me. Love from Paul Altman. I am 6 years old."
Even 50 years ago, not that many philosophers were getting fan letters from six-year-olds. So I asked Paul, now a doctor working in Oxford, what it was that inspired him to write to someone seemingly so removed from the day-to-day life of a young child.
"I suppose what struck me was how seemingly altruistic he was, and that, he clearly thought about bigger things than his own household. And to me, that was a rather novel thing, and I think that concern about the bigger picture was something that always did inspire me in practically everything that I do, I suppose."
His radio and television appearances continued well into his last decade. In a special broadcast to mark his 90th birthday, this recording was played of Russell reading his own obituary, one he'd written for himself some 25 years earlier, of what he thought the Times would say of him when he died at the predicted age of 90.
"His life, for all its waywardness, had a certain anachronistic consistency,
reminiscent of that of the aristocratic rebels of the early 19th century. His principles were curious, but such as they were, they governed his actions. In private life, he showed none of the acerbity which marred his writings, but was a genial conversationalist, not devoid of human sympathy. He had many friends, but had survived almost all of them. Nevertheless, to those who remained, he appeared in extreme old age, full of enjoyment, no doubt owing in large measure to his invariable health. For politically, during his last years, he was as isolated as Milton after the Restoration. He was the last survivor of a dead epoch.
The interviewer Jack Singleton, talking to Russell at his home in North Wales, reminded him of the incident during the First World War where he was attacked and saved not for his intellect and academic standing, but in fact for his noble birth. Now 90, did he think things had changed much?
Has society changed much since then, Lord Russell? Does being an earl give you any protection today?
I don't think society has changed in this respect. And I think that I derive even more protection from being an earl than I formerly did from being an earl's brother. I do not, of course, favour protection on this ground, though I cannot but be glad of it on occasion.
Russell may have been the first media star of the intellectual world, but unlike most media stars, his appearances were backed up by a depth of knowledge and understanding, a charm and compassion that makes him as relevant today as he was 40 years ago. I may never find time to read all the 71 books that he found time to write, but I'll keep going and continue to be enthused and fascinated by a man who spent his life attempting to spread wisdom and humanity using all the means at his disposal.
Three passions, simple but overwhelmingly strong, have governed my life. The longing for love, the search for knowledge, and unbearable pity for the suffering of mankind. This has been my life. I have found it worth living, and would gladly live it again if the chance were offered me.
Bertrand Russell, the first media academic, was presented by Robin Ince. The producer was Alexandra Feacham.